RN, your daily commute companion. On RN, online, at abc.net.au or via podcast, you're with Big Ideas. Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for your company. There are over 70 countries around the world today that have some sort of legislation offering the public the right to know. And in this evening's talk, we'll consider the significance and origins of FOI, Freedom of Information. Where, how, and why did it all begin? And how has it changed society? Michael Shudson, Professor of Journalism at Columbia University, notes that it's been a long-term trend. The move towards greater transparency and disclosure has been with us since the early 1950s. But it wasn't until 1966 in the US that the first modern FOI Act was published. And in tonight's lecture, Shudson explains what freedom of information means, how it works, and why it's become globally significant. And it's not just governments and their agencies that have changed the way they operate. Businesses, organisations, individuals, whole societies have also been affected by a move towards greater openness and accountability. Let's head now to the University of Sydney for a surprisingly short history of the right to know, presented by Sydney Ideas and the Department of Media and Communications at the University of Sydney, in association with the School of Communications at UTS and the Sydney Democracy Network. Here's Professor Michael Shudson.
The talk I want to give is primarily about the origins of the U.S. Freedom of Information Act, but it's part of a book that Harvard University Press will publish in the fall that is focused on a somewhat broader topic. And the argument of the book is that in the past 50 years, we've seen in the U.S. and elsewhere around the world, but my focus is the U.S., a strong trend toward fuller disclosure and fuller sense among people that they have a right to such disclosure. Governmental disclosure, but also person-to-person or professional-to-client disclosure as well. A sense that openness is part of the ethos of democratic life and a democratic citizenship. And I thought I should say just a few words in introduction about the larger compass of the book and just give you a couple of stories about that. The book focuses on the period 1945 to 1975. And initially I thought, in fact, that the story I wanted to tell was a story of the 60s, as we think of it, the cultural revolution of the 60s. And it is in part that. The surprisingly short part is that it did not go back to the American founding fathers. It's not an 18th century development, although it's hard to think of it having happened without the 18th century and without the Enlightenment, but it didn't happen then and there, although even those who wrote the Freedom of Information Act in 1966 thought it did. They did not appreciate their own ingenuity. It was not the founding fathers, nor did it wait for the internet. A lot happened in this, particularly the period 1960 to 1975. A couple of examples. Two stories and one statistic. The statistic is that, this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, two surveys. One surveyed doctors in 1961 and asked them if when they treated a patient with cancer, they mentioned to the patient that he or she had cancer. And the result of that survey found that 12% told their cancer patients that they had cancer. 12%. That's 1961. Some enterprising medical scholar said in 1979, let's try that survey again. And the result in 1979 was that 98% told their cancer patients that they had cancer. Now, that did not take a Freedom of Information Act. That was a change in the culture of medical care. And it was a very important one. And it has lasted more or less to this day. Another example, this is something of a story that you may or may not know about. In the early 60s, a technician working for the U.S. Public Health Service in San Francisco, a man named Peter Buxton, heard on the grapevine in the Public Health Service that there was an ongoing Public Health Service-sponsored experiment in Tuskegee, Alabama, in which African-American men with syphilis were being treated by Public Health Service doctors and nurses for every disease that they happened to have, every cold, every fever, but not syphilis. The syphilis was to be untreated, even though when the experiment began, I mean, syphilis was a serious disease, and it remained a serious disease up until sometime in the 1940s, when it became clear that now a widely available penicillin would treat it, end it, cure it. The experiment continued. The patients, or the people who had agreed without much knowledge to participate in the experiment, didn't know that they had syphilis. They said they had bad blood. And even when treatment was possible, they were not given the treatment for it. So in the 1960s, this experiment was continuing. Peter Buxton, being a trusting fellow, went to his superiors in the Public Health Service and said, do you know about this experiment going on in Tuskegee, and shouldn't we end it? And they treated Mr. Buxton as a troublemaker and put him off, and nothing happened. He couldn't get it out of his head. And some years later, he said again, he came back to them again, he was put aside, and he finally said, this is ridiculous. And he had a friend in the news media and went to his friend, said, I've heard about this story. I think you could probably find documentation for it. It still is going on in Alabama, and it's outrageous. And his friend said, well, I have to go cover the Republican National Convention. I can't deal with it now, but I'll pass your information on to a friend of mine, also at that point working for the Associated Press. The friend was a young woman named Jean Heller, an investigative reporter for the AP. She talked to the Public Health Service. They actually quickly confirmed the story. They provided her a bunch of information. She did not have to use a Freedom of Information Act, though it was then available. And the only question was where to publish it. The Washington Post, she wanted it to be in Washington. The Washington Post was suddenly very busy with something called Watergate. So she worried that it would not make the front page. So at that time, not now, but at that time, there was another important paper in Washington, the Washington Star. And she said, this is your story, Washington Star, if you agree to put it on page one. They put it on page one. So this was June 25th, 1972, page one of the Washington Star. Very soon thereafter, page one of the New York Times. And within days, this is those of you in media and communication studies, this is a media effect, if ever there was one. The experiment was halted within days. After going on for 40 years and killing several hundred people. After the story came out, Jean Heller went back to visit her family in Ohio. I guess there was a dinner at her home, and the her parents' best friend, she told me, was a doctor, and he responded to her when she told him about the story, "That's not true." And she said that she had felt the same way. She said, "I had this pedestal the medical and legal fraternity stood on. It was quite a rude awakening for me. The scales fell from my eyes. It's a terrible cliche, but this was an evil I couldn't comprehend. What were these people thinking?" But they were legitimate public health service physicians, nurses. I don't know exactly what they were thinking either, but it took until 1972 for it to stop. Oh, by the way, you know, Peter Buxton clearly was a whistleblower. The term was new. I mean, it may have been used here and there, but it wasn't until 1970 that it came into the common usage in at least American English. One more story. 1974, Gerald Ford has succeeded Richard Nixon in the White House toward the end of the year, in August. In just a month or 6 weeks later, Mrs. Ford, in some ways a much more important figure than President Ford, Mrs. Ford had a physical exam. There was a lump in one of her breasts. She went in to see if it was cancerous or not. And if it was, at that point, it was standard practice that there would be a radical mastectomy, which is what happened in her case. And almost immediately after she recovered, she was on the lecture circuit talking about breast cancer and breast cancer awareness. There were a couple other women in the U.S. who had also talked about their own breast cancer and breast cancer operations, but certainly no one more prominent than the First Lady. And she made an interesting comment to a magazine writer some years later with this explanation for why she and President Ford felt that she should be very public about this quickly. She said, "There had been so much cover-up during Watergate that we wanted to be sure there would be no cover-up in the Ford administration. So rather than continue this traditional silence about breast cancer, we felt we had to be very public." Incidentally, it was just a few weeks later that amendments to the Freedom of Information Act, which made it much stronger, came to the president for signature, and President Ford vetoed the amendments. That veto was quickly overridden in the Congress. That's another story. But that's the kind of broad cultural shift that interested me and drew me to this subject. And one piece of the subject that seemed very important to me was to understand the Freedom of Information Act. Where did it come from? People who supported the act, which passed almost unanimously in the Congress in 1966. I don't know why they all decided to give roughly the same speech, but almost all of them quoted the same lines from James Madison, one of our hallowed founders and the chief architect of the U.S. Constitution. And it is an impressive quotation. It goes, "A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a tragedy or a farce or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power knowledge gives." But the Freedom of Information Act became law in 1966, not in 1787, when Madison and his colleagues hammered out the Constitution, nor in 1822 when he wrote about the importance of popular information in a popular government. He wrote that line in a letter to a friend who was looking for endorsement of a bill to support public elementary education in the state of Kentucky. What Madison was endorsing was that people should be educated, not that people had a right to request of their government the disclosure of information that the government had gathered. I don't think Madison or Jefferson or others would have approved, they certainly never conceived, but I don't think that they would have approved what became the Freedom of Information Act. Nothing like it would have been conceivable. The Constitution says nothing about a right to know or about the importance of popular information in democracy. So my short history does not go back to 1787. It's surprising because Americans tend to think everything good began in 1787. This is good, but it began not in 1966, that's when it came to culmination, but basically in 1953. So the short history is the 12 years between 53, 13 years, and 66. What is the Freedom of Information Act, at least in the U.S. version? And though what John said in introduction is I believe, correct, that the U.S. FOIA, in short, some people say FOI, the U.S. Journalists and others refer to the act as FOIA, Freedom of Information Act. There were two earlier laws. 1766, Sweden beat us by a couple hundred years, and Finland, 1951, but neither had a kind of world impact. Today, there are more than 70 countries with some kind of freedom of information legislation. Some of it's quite good. Some of it's better than what we have in the United States. Some of it is not as good. China has a Freedom of Information Act. I don't think it does quite what one would like it to do. But let me tell you what the U.S. Act does, and I'm going to have to get a little bit technical for 2 minutes. There are three significant features that make this FOIA an important one. The first of these three features is simply the original provision that it is okay, it is established and legitimate for individuals, citizens or non-citizens, actually persons, to request information from the U.S. government. You have to fill out a form. You should do your best to send the form to the right agency that might actually have the information. You should be clear about what you want, not ask for something wholesale, and so forth. There's some technical, but all of them reasonable requirements, and the government is obliged to respond to you. It covers the executive agencies, and in this way differs from the more recently passed British Freedom of Information Act, which covers the parliament. The U.S. law does not cover the Congress. It covers executive agencies under the supervision nominally or actually of the U.S. president. The second part of the law says the government should disclose information to you unless it fits within one of nine exemptions. And I won't go through all nine, but some of them are very important and fairly obvious, I think. Some not so obvious. So the exemptions that the government is can legitimately use to withhold information is information designated by an executive order to remain secret for the sake of national defense or foreign policy. We may come back to that. Another exemption is information related exclusively to internal personnel practices. Third, information specifically exempt from disclosure by legislative statute. It's written into the statute that information related to whatever this happens to be, agricultural pesticides or whatever it is to be born secret. Trade secrets is another one. One that is somewhat controversial is what the courts have called pre-decisional deliberation. I think it deserves a laugh. But pre-decisional deliberation is when a committee is meeting in some executive agency and trying to come up with a policy. The idea is that people should, to encourage freedom of inquiry and speech inside the government, you have to be able to keep it secret, confidential, from outside the government. You want a trial balloon, you want to provoke the person across the table from you, you want to be able to say things that will move the process along to coming to a good decision, you don't want to see it on the front page of the New York Times the next day, or ever. Privacy, personnel and medical files whose disclosure would invade personal privacy, the government can withhold. Information compiled for law enforcement purposes, and so forth. So, as a Freedom of Information officer sees it, they are supposed to disclose as much information as does not fit within those nine categories and withhold any and all information that does fall within the categories. The third feature, the first feature, citizens and others can request information from the government. The government is obliged to disclose information unless it falls within an exemption. And third, if you did not get the information you wanted and you believe that it was withheld improperly, that is, it didn't really fit within an exemption, you can sue. You can take that executive agency to court, and a judge will decide whether that agency properly or improperly withheld the information. If it was improper, they will command it, the judge will command it to be released. Let me give you, so that's it for the technical details. Let me just give you two examples. 2007, New York Times reporter Nina Bernstein wrote a front page story about the imprisonment of immigrants who violated conditions of their visitor status, sometimes languishing in detention for months or longer. And in some horrifying cases, she learned, 20 people had died in custody. She learned of the deaths from her various sources. She is a terrific journalist. Her request, she filed a Freedom of Information Act request. Her request was met, as is too often the case, with a long silence. But then one day, she's at her desk, and a package is delivered to it. And it has the information that she had requested. Actually, it had more than she had requested, and the shocking evidence that there were 66 people who had died in custody, often held in custody for very minor violations. And it was a pretty shocking story, very embarrassing to the government, and a stimulus to reform. Bernstein's request became the topic of a New York Times column by the ombudsman or public editor, Clark Hoyt. Hoyt observed the Times reporters make aggressive use of FOIA, and that Bernstein's was one of two that had appeared recently. He talked about that one. He talked about this other one by David Barstow. Barstow had written a story about how the Pentagon had influenced retired military officers who were serving in the early days of the Iraq War as analysts on commercial television, commenting on exactly what was happening, giving presumably neutral analysis of what was going on from the point of view of an expert, retired officer. Barstow was skeptical about the value of that expertise, and he filed a FOIA request in 2006 for background about these analysts and any communication they might have had while being TV commentators with the Pentagon itself. His FOIA request was denied. He appealed the request. The appeal was turned down a few months later. He kept trying, and in the end, he received some 700 pages of documents from the Defense Department. A bit more information trickled in thereafter, but less than he had requested. And the explanations for the denial were not to him credible. So he went to his editors at the New York Times, and they agreed they would sue the Pentagon. And they won. Still, the Pentagon moved rather slowly to comply. Finally, Barstow's story ran April 2008, 2 full years after his original FOIA request. Several days later, he received an additional 3,000 pages from the Defense Department. Barstow is not happy with all of this. He called FOIA a cruel joke. Nevertheless, early in 2009, his reporting on the TV military analyst won the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting, confirmed the importance of his work, and amplified its influence in the country. So, two stories deeply critical of federal policy, both embarrassing to Washington, were made possible in part by FOIA. And FOIA keeps some 4,000 bureaucrats busy answering some 600,000 requests a year at a total cost of some $350 million. So whether it's successful all the time or not is one question, but it is certainly successful in having created an additional bureaucracy in Washington. We're good at that. But it seems to me that even those two stories, complicated as the stories, are evidence that FOIA has made a difference, can make a difference, and it does so over and over again.
On RN or online at abc.net.au, you're with Big Ideas, and tonight we're in Sydney for The Right to Know, a short history of freedom of information. Your speaker is Michael Shudson, Professor of Journalism at Columbia University in New York. Let's return now to the University of Sydney, where Michael Shudson is about to shed some light on who was responsible for bringing freedom of information legislation to life.
If James Madison didn't think about it, think of it, who did? If there's a... there are various people, but the person widely acknowledged among the 200 people who know or care about this, to be the father of the Freedom of Information Act was a California congressman named John Moss, a longtime Democratic activist who was a small businessman in Sacramento. He had 2 years of college. He was not a philosopher, not a political thinker the way James Madison indeed was. He was, as the New York Times described him in 1956, a grave, quiet, hardworking, humorless, undramatic, 42-year-old Democratic representative from California. So why him? Where'd this idea come from? Well, he becomes a member of Congress in he's elected in 1952, takes office in 1953. He, as a freshman, he's put on the lowest of the low committees, which is the Post Office and Civil Service Committee. And he's hardworking and conscientious. So the first thing he does, or very early in his term, is to request some information from the Civil Service Commission. He's interested in, it's the early Cold War, it's the McCarthy era. He's interested to show that the outgoing Truman administration had been very conscientious about looking for communists and in the government and had successfully dismissed those whose loyalty might be questioned. That was his effort. But the Civil Service Commission did not give him much help with this. He requested the information, and the Civil Service Commission said no. And he turned to his colleagues, and everyone said, that's a final answer, John. There's nothing you can do about it. There is no law in America that says an executive agency is obliged to share its information with the Congress. Well, Moss was shocked. This was Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. This was an ordinary man, really, who just believed in democracy or what he'd learned in the third grade about democracy. And this was not consistent with that. It was the case, he said later, of a freshman being somewhat outraged over executive arrogance. At that point, 1953-4, the Republicans controlled the House of Representatives. In the 54 election, that changes. The Democrats take control. A new subcommittee is created and on government information, and John Moss is appointed as chair. And he found early on that it might be advisable to consult with journalists who would also have an interest in this topic. Let me just parenthetically stop for a moment and say that before 1955, there was no organized attention to government secrecy anywhere in the U.S. Congress. This was the first, 1955. Second, the key figure here, Moss, was born in 1913, as were quite a number of other people born in that year. They were not 60s people. He was a generation before the 60s, even though his legislation didn't culminate until 1966. He came of political age in the Depression and World War II, not in anti-war demonstrations during Vietnam. And the third point to make here is that this is also the late 40s and early 50s, the first time that journalists take an organized interest in secrecy in government. A couple of journalism organizations in the late 40s for the first time take an interest in freedom of information, but they're interested in what they call world freedom of information. That is, they took it for granted that the Americans had this all down. I mean, we had the First Amendment, we're a free society, we're the free part of the free world. We can teach others how to have freedom of information. That was their, and they did a worldwide tour looking at the imperfect nations elsewhere before they figured out, you know, we may have a problem ourselves in Washington. Once they figured that out, they became John Moss's closest allies. They testified before his committee. They gave him examples of cases where what should have been public information was being withheld. They allowed Moss to hold hearing after hearing that was embarrassing to the executive, which was particularly good 1953 to 61 because the executive was Republican and Moss was a Democrat. Party politics figures in here as well. Moss came to all of this from his interest in getting information from the Civil Service Committee on forward in the context of the Cold War. This is the, and he made use of Cold War rhetoric at every opportunity. He fired away at government secrecy, not only in subcommittee hearings, but on the lecture circuit, where he could both be entertaining sometimes, humorless though he might have been called, and grab headlines. He made repeated reference to the Cold War, transparency or freedom of information. became for him a tool in relation to the Cold War and the defense of the free world. No rhetoric was more salient or more available or more powerful than Cold War rhetoric. Freedom of information became a political issue because of growing secrecy in government that emerged out of World War II, particularly emerged in relation to the development of atomic weapons. But secrecy also grew simply as the bureaucracy took on more tasks and what has been called an administrative state became larger, more permanent, and more independent of congressional oversight. Moss fought secrecy on behalf of Congress. His crusade was an exercise in what political scientists have called horizontal accountability, not accountability of the government vertically to voters, but horizontally from one agency of government or from one branch of government to another in the separation of powers. Moss spoke repeatedly of what he called the paper curtain of executive secrecy in Washington. He picked that up from journalists themselves, and the term paper curtain obviously played off of Winston Churchill's Iron Curtain, popularized to characterize the Soviet domination of the satellite countries of Eastern Europe. Often, Moss called attention to instances where the Soviets were more open than the Americans. In a 1957 speech, he observed that the Russians published much of their research on the peaceful uses of atomic energy in open technological journals. This has been going on in Russian publications, he said, for more than a year, but practically all information in the same areas are still classified in the United States. He directly accused the American executive of using Soviet tactics. In 1959, he attacked the Pentagon for embarking on Soviet-style control of the news, giving out the good news, hiding the failures. In 1960, he compared Air Force information policies to a species of thought police who will tell us what to think under pain of whatever sanction appears to be appropriate to the administration in power. Obviously, the notion of a thought police borrowed from George Orwell. The leading advocate in the U.S. Senate, Thomas Hennings from Missouri, asserted that the American founders believed in a right in the people to know what their government was doing. That, too, was good rhetoric, but it was very poor history. Did the founders believe that Republican government required informed citizens? Yes, but in their terms, not in ours. Nowhere did they indicate that being informed meant that citizens should be able to make demands for information upon those serving in the government. They did not even imagine that citizens needed to keep up to date with the public issues of the day. Even Thomas Jefferson, among the more radical of the founders, advocated public education so that people would have enough sense of history to be wary of demagogues and to recognize demagoguery when they saw it. Education would help people, to quote Jefferson, would help people know ambition under all its shapes and prompt them to exercise their natural powers to defeat its purposes. Jefferson advocated popular education as a defense against bad leadership, not as a mechanism to make popular debate the source of policy choices. And by the way, Jefferson's bill to establish public education in the state of Virginia failed to pass. Of course, citizens were expected to have some kind of information in order to vote intelligently. But what information would that be? For the founders, it was knowledge of the personal character of the candidates, not opinions about the public policies they might favor. The founders were wary of direct appeals to the people. They were ambivalent about the press. They were suspicious of political parties and even civic or voluntary associations that President Washington judged to be arrogant, presumptuous, and dangerous when they recommended particular courses of action to the leadership. Who were they, the people, to recommend anything when they had not themselves sat in Congress and heard the debates? Were there newspapers? Yes, there were newspapers. But the U.S. Senate met in secret for its first 6 years, completely in secret. And the debates were not well covered until sometime later. And the idea of participation and back and forth was something that Congress was established for that purpose in the minds of the founders. The public should vote according to character, send their representatives to Washington, check in with them again 2 years later. And you know, when you just a short excursion to this country, the way people voted in Virginia in the 1760s, 1770s, for basically more than a century, was that the candidates for office would stand up by the clerk who was taking the votes, and you would go up to the clerk and you would give the clerk your vote out loud, by the way, then you would go over to whichever candidate you had voted for. They would shake hands, thank you for your vote. And by the way, it was the leading citizens of the community who voted first, so that you ordinary white male owning property would know which way the wind was blowing before you got there. The big change in that, in the American style of voting, came with the adoption of, I don't know what it's called here, but in America it's called the Australian ballot, in which the ballot is provided by the state, not by the parties, and has on it the candidates for office from as many parties as qualified to be on the ballot. So you would be actually making a choice, marking a piece of paper that had not been customary. And that came in the late 1880s, 1890s. From Australia, thank you. I've gone through one of 3 points in explaining how we got the Freedom of Information Act, the politics of it, or at least an important part of the politics of it. There are two other things I want to talk about more briefly. One is, as my opening remarks suggested, I think there was a broad cultural change that was going on here, and more than I know how to encompass, but this shift to a more open society was a complicated matter. It began somewhere in the 40s and 50s. It culminates and reaches a kind of flowering in the 60s and 70s. And it is still with us, I believe, National Security Agency notwithstanding. But how does that happen? And I don't know the answer to that, I'm afraid. But I want to add one more piece to what is generally has been written by historians. And this piece is, I don't know how I would do this, but my next big research project, if I ever get to it, is to integrate the history of higher education into the history of society. There are historians of higher education possibly in this room, but there's very little I don't think anything in a kind of general U.S. history textbook, and I'm not sure about the case here, that puts the history of higher education in relationship to the rest of what's going on in society. There was a broad social change after World War II in the U.S. In the expansion of the percentage of the population tripling that went to college and graduated from college. It was still a minority for a long time. Now it's about half. And it expanded a little more quickly than was the case in Europe, but it expanded there too. That's important. And in the American case, where where there was provision of free education to veterans of World War II and other veterans. It made the population in college much more varied than it had been, and much more mature than it had been. But there was also a change in the quality and character and ethos of what went on in higher education. A little less, or a lot less, recitation, and more discussion, less Greek and Latin, more Spanish and Russian, less reverence for the classics, and more, even if you're still teaching the classics, an effort to get students to think about them, maybe even criticize them, and maybe even think about, well, how did that one get to be called a classic? What is a canon? What is canon formation? A kind of, I guess I say this in part because I was trained in sociology, but a kind of sociology of knowledge as an element in everyday life at the university level. There was also an increasingly central role for science rather than the humanities, and for lessons in critical inquiry rather than the handing down of tradition. The increasingly professionalized disciplines, as one historian says, were embarrassed by moralism and sentiment. They were openly or implicitly drawn to the model of science as a vision of professional maturity. An open-minded self, writes one historian, Jamie Cohen Cole, an open-minded self became the model person in academic society. Reinforced by the Cold War, open-mindedness came to be seen as a core attribute of the democratic citizen. As the Cold War and the Soviet success in space exploration advanced with the launch of Sputnik in 1957, stimulating vastly increased federal aid to education and higher education and research in the U.S., so also did rivalry with the closed society of the Soviet Union accelerate a strong rhetorical commitment to openness as the defining feature of the cast of mind appropriate to small d democratic citizens. That's the second point. So the political context, the broad cultural context, and I guess the third thing I would note is that certain specific events make a difference and they don't fit into anything in particular. The event that is important here is, I've already mentioned it earlier, Watergate. FOIA was a landmark in 1966, but as a relatively weak law in the form in which John Moss wrote it and it was passed. Within a year or two of its passage, a young man not terribly well known then, but he would soon be very well known, Ralph Nader, wrote an article in a law review called about FOIA. He called it the Freedom From Information Act. And you can hear echoes of that even much more, like in the examples I gave earlier, or the line of a reporter I know who said that she and some of her reporter friends send birthday cards to their FOIA requests because it takes years, not months or weeks, for them to be answered. But the event here was Watergate because the FOIA needed to be amended in 1974. This was the work particularly of Senator Ted Kennedy. A set of FOIA amendments, I'll spare you the details, but it made it a much stronger law than it had been. In one detail, there were now deadlines for agencies to respond. There had not been earlier. The current deadline is, I believe, 20 working days. Is it always met? No. But it's there, it's on record, and then you can object when you don't hear in 20 working days. Ford vetoed it, the Congress overrode it, and Kennedy declared the override a visible and concrete repudiation by Congress of both the traditional bureaucratic secrecy of the federal establishment and the special anti-media, anti-public, anti-Congress secrecy of the Nixon administration. Let me conclude by quoting the English poet, Shelley, when he wrote that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. I'd like to reverse that and say that occasionally, not often, but occasionally, legislators are the unacknowledged poets of the world. And that there is some poetry that I think we Americans, and perhaps others too, have missed in the Freedom of Information Act. Some of that poetry is condensed in one phrase, simple phrase. Any person may request, is authorized to request information from the U.S. government. This is the phrase that John Moss himself highlighted as one of the most important features of the bill. Any person can initiate a request. The requester automatically has standing and faces no hurdles to jump, to make a request. Doesn't have to show that the request is pertinent to anything. Doesn't have to show it's pertinent to the public good or the public interest. Just has to put in the request according to the forms. One need not even be a U.S. citizen. So if you all want to file a U.S. FOIA request tonight, you can do so. There are online forms available. This relieves the agencies from any need to pass judgment on the requester, and therefore it saves a great deal of time and expense in the bureaucracy, clearing the way for a request to be examined on its face. The practicality of that is obvious, but I think the poetry is obvious too. It is a richer, more universal, and more complete rendering of democratic equality than the American founders ever dreamt of or expressed. Thank you.
You've been listening to Freedom of Information, A Short History of the Right to Know. Your speaker was Michael Shudson, Professor of Journalism at Columbia University. This evening's lecture was presented by Sydney Ideas and the Department of Media and Communications at the University of Sydney, in association with the School of Communications at UTS and the Sydney Democracy Network. That's just about it for Big Ideas for tonight. You can download audio of this or any of our talks from the Big Ideas homepage, or you can become a regular subscriber to our podcasts for Big Ideas delivered to you each and every week for free. For further details, find us at abc.net.au/rn and select Big Ideas from the drop-down program menu. Tomorrow night, join me for a discussion on the personalization of digital media. It's changed how and when you consume your favorite shows, how the media works, how advertising looks and reaches you. In this discussion, a panel explores the growth, sophistication and future direction of personalized media. How do organizations tap into it? And what's the role of the consumer? That's Big Ideas tomorrow night, or download anytime from the RN website. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.